It's a beautiful Thursday morning and it's 11 a.m. here at Prashanthinilam. That means it's time for this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I welcome you all to this week's show by, as always, offering our most loving pranams at the lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, in whose love we have found warmth and solace, loving whom has given us a purpose in life, and learning to love him more is what purifies every action, word and thought of us. Well, sometimes I feel there is really nothing more one needs to do. We don't have to read books, do meditation or do anything for that matter. Just try our best to love Swami more and more with every passing day. That will make us do all that we need to do. Every sadhana, every act of kindness, and even the pursuit of higher knowledge will only be a partial expression of that inexpressible feeling of love. It's the answering booth, so we indeed have a question to deal with. It's a simple one, but important nevertheless, just like every other question we have dealt with on this program. But before going to that, let me inflict on each one of you a quote that I read and enjoyed, with the fond hope that you will listen and enjoy it as well. The quote is from a very popular author. His book is one of the most famous modern-day classics in personality development. Well, the book is Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and the author is Stephen Covey. And these are the words I would like to read out for you today. I quote, "Every human has four endowments: self-awareness, conscience, independent will, and creative imagination. These give us the power to discern, to choose, to respond, to change." End of quote. Well, I think in two lines, Stephen Covey has defined human nature itself and taken away possibly all excuses we can give for our lapses. The first endowment he talks about is self-awareness. Well, this is the basis of Vedanta philosophy itself, that we are not learning to be self-aware, but we are learning that we are already self-aware, that awareness is just clouded by our ignorance. The ultimate state is when we have that constant integrated awareness, as Swami would put it. But even before we reach that permanent state, we can experience flashes of this self-awareness and use it in our day-to-day life. We don't realize, but feelings such as love, compassion and selflessness actually comes from this self-awareness. And the more we operate from these feelings, we are using that hidden self-awareness. The next endowment he talks about is conscience, the infallible moral compass within each one of us. We often are stuck in situations and say, "Oh, this is impossible for me. I just don't know what to do. I have not been trained to deal with the situation." Well, but the truth is, there is no decision for which this conscience does not give a precise answer. And we need no training for that. Most often, it is our fear and sense of insecurity that makes us turn away from what the conscience says. So life's journey is not to learn to make decisions, but to learn to overcome our fears and selflessly follow the conscience. The next two are independent will and creative imagination. We've had a number of questions on this theme. Are we slaves of our tendencies? Are we slaves of our fate and situations? The answer is clearly given by Swami in so many of his discourses. Our will is as powerful as the divine will itself. In fact, there is no difference. Swami would often say that his will or sankalpa is vajra sankalpa, a will as unbreakable as a diamond. If Swami wills something, it is bound to happen. But Swami doesn't stop with that. He says each one of us is capable of such willpower. We only have to become as pure as him, as selfless as he is. So we all have that will to change anything within and without us. It has been placed inside each of us by Swami. Finally, creative imagination. Once I read somewhere that if you wish to change status quo, you must first change the way you think. You cannot think in the same linear way and expect that things will change. Think differently, then we will try different approaches and things will happen differently. look for solutions to your everyday problems, sticking to the eternal values, of course, but through innovative and imaginative thinking. I wouldn't be overstating when I say that we as a human race have been responsible for a lot of mess on this planet. But much of it can be sorted out if we put our heads together and come up with imaginative solutions, isn't it? Well, we have done it in so many cases too. We can do much more, and we can do much more in our personal lives too, through imaginative and creative thinking. But these four qualities or endowments are what makes human life precious. So precious that it is capable of transcending the limits of humanness itself. Before we head to the question for this week, dear listeners, permit me to read that quote by Stephen Covey one more time. I quote, "Every human has four endowments: self-awareness, conscience, independent will, and creative imagination. These give us the power to discern, to choose, to respond, and to change." Let's head to the question for this week then. Today's question is from Mr. Narayanan from Palakkad. It's a simple question, but no question is simple, as we've seen in the past so many weeks. But Mr. Narayanan has also sent his question in his own voice, very kind of him. So we will listen to the question that he has in his own voice, and after that, let's proceed and try to answer the question for him.
Sai Ram, when I go for my morning walk, I used to chant Lord's name or chant Sai Gayatri. But I have a feeling in my mind that I am chanting the Lord's name with my footwear on. Is it correct to do so? And in the same manner, while I lie on bed for sleep, I chant Lord's name or Sai Gayatri until I get sleep. But some people say that we should not chant the name of the Lord while lying on the bed. So I am confused. Please enlighten me with regard to this doubt. Thank you, Sai Ram.
Thank you very much, sir, for that question. Well, if I have to answer that question in one sentence, it's certainly not wrong at all. Namasmarana can be done at all times, and that is what Swami has always told us. But it's a important question, and it actually talks about a conundrum and that we are generally placed in, especially when relating to some of these spiritual practices like Namasmarana or bhajans or any of these spiritual practices that we undertake. So let's take this opportunity of this question and talk about this a little more in detail. First, we'll talk about why we have such rules at all, that we should not wear footwear when we are doing puja, or we have to have a bath and have puja. You know, we have so many such methodologies even for worship. In Sanskrit, we often use this word called paddhati, which means it's the means or method of doing a certain activity. And especially they're very particular when it comes to religious tasks or tasks which one performs as an offering, as a worship, as an archana, or in a temple, or in an altar. So why do we have these various kinds of rules and regulations when we have to do a certain worship? And this is not the case only for Sanatana Dharma. Every religion and every temple and every place of worship has its own rules and regulations. As we know, most of the temples, we are not allowed to wear a footwear inside. At least in India, we very strictly follow that. In Sanatana Dharma, that's a very basic necessity for you to be able to enter a temple. But there are some other places, there are some temples in Kerala where I hear that, you know, if you go, you're supposed to take off your shirt. If you're a male person trying to enter the temple, you have to go bare-bodied. That is a necessity. There are some temples that insist that you should be wearing a sari or an Indian attire if you want to go inside. If you go into a gurudwara, you're supposed to cover your head. They'll give you a headscarf by which you're supposed to tie it and cover your head and go inside. And I'm sure that every religion and every place of worship has its own rules and regulations. So what is the necessity for doing such things? Well, to start off with, before I tell you what is the purpose behind all these things, does God require us to do these things for Him to accept our prayers? I think that's not the case at all. But we'll come to that in a bit. But if these things are not necessary to be done so that, you know, our offering becomes acceptable to God, then why do we do them at all? There are four purposes, widely categorized, but I don't think this is comprehensive. But just for our understanding, why do we have some rules and regulations, rituals and customs, especially related to some forms of worship and when it comes to spiritual practices? There are four purposes that I'm going to list down. As I said, these are not comprehensive, but they'll give you an idea as, you know, what I'm trying to convey. First one is, many of these practices actually may be scientific. There might be a certain scientific benefit that we are supposed to get from this, but it has been passed down as rituals. In fact, sometime back I was seeing this video, somebody had forwarded it to me about how in one of the universities in the US they're doing a research as to that particular exercise that we would do in front of a Ganesha temple, where we would catch both our ears and do squats. We used to sit up and get up. Right? We used to do that as a punishment, or if you go to a Ganesha temple, you're supposed to do that. They are doing research in that, and they're finding that how it is a simple exercise which kind of tackles some very, very advanced problems. If I'm not wrong, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and such things. I mean, don't take my word for that. But they were doing research as to how beneficial this simple act is. But in our tradition, it has been passed on to us as a spiritual tradition that when you go in front of a Ganesha temple, you're supposed to do this. Or for that matter, many, many small things that we would do. For instance, when the Muslims perform their namaz, they sit in what we refer to in yoga as Vajrasana, right? And Vajrasana has a number of benefits. It helps you in the process of digestion. It helps you in your the better posturing of your spinal cord. I mean, the list of benefits of Vajrasana are endless. But it has been used as a form in which you perform your worship. Maybe in many of these customs that we follow, for instance, even taking off your slippers and going to a temple, there are innumerable benefits of walking barefoot, which now they're talking about, you know, how the various pressure points at the sole of your feet, and when you walk barefoot, how it benefits you. Or for that matter, the kind of offerings that we do. For instance, the coconut offering which we do, they find that coconut seems to be one of the best supplements in the diet that we could have. So in that sense, I think many of these customs, many of these rituals that have been included, maybe that, I mean, this is something which is universal. In a society, most people go to a temple, most people perform some form of worship, some form of puja, at least in the past, you could be sure of that. Every festival included certain types of rituals and customs that you follow. So by introducing some of these things which are scientifically beneficial to us, which benefits our health, which benefits our mental health, all of these are put into customs and rituals and passed on as tradition so that we can draw benefit from it, whether or not we understand the value of these things. That is one of the purposes for which many of these customs and practices are handed down to us. The second thing is, many of these rituals are actually a form of a cultural discipline. Whenever a group of individuals come together and form a community, when they come and form a society, when they form a religious community, a sectarian community, or whatever it is, the way they bind together, the way they become one unit, is through some of these customs and traditions, right? As somebody was very beautifully explaining that there were these group of individuals who came together and they said that we don't believe in God anymore. So we've become atheists. So we don't believe in this entity called divinity or God. So then they form a group. They all come together, people with like-minded approach to life. They come together and form this group of atheists. So after they form this group, then they start coming up with their own traditions of how you will express your non-belief or your ability to not accept an entity like God. So they started forming some traditions like, you know, what they would do when they come across a temple, or what they would do when they come across an idol which is considered sacred by the believers. So in a sense, if a group of people come together and they want to bind as a unit, automatically they start doing certain things in a certain manner. They say that when we go to a temple, we will pray like this. All people who wish to be part of our group will pray in this manner. All people who wish to be part of our group will sing these songs and pray to God, or, you know, or perform these rituals and pray to God. So it helps in that communal binding of a set of individuals. And that's why everything, you know, be it the way we perform our marriages, the way we perform our naming ceremonies, or the way we perform our funerals, all of this comes from that. When a group of individuals come together, they list down some things which they would do, and it's a common practice, right? It gives a sense of belonging, and it helps in binding that group together. Because there needs to be something common for a group to be together, and not just about 10 or 15 individuals, it's even about generations of binding we're talking about, right? So that helps. So the first benefit I spoke about was some kind of scientific health benefits. Or the second thing is for this cultural discipline, which leads to a sense of belonging and helps in bonding in the group. The third purpose which I can think of is, you know, many of the things that we do in the form of devotion, as inspired by devotion, many of these are emotions which are very, very abstract. When you say, you know, first of all, we are lucky that we have Swami, we've seen Swami in a physical form, we can relate to God in just like how I relate to my mother or father, I can relate to Swami too. But when you're talking about a group of individuals praying to divinity, which probably they've not seen, especially if they don't believe in God having a form, or you know, if they're praying to a symbol of God, let's say like the lingam or something like that. When you say, I love God, that feeling becomes very, very abstract. When I say, I love so-and-so, I love my mother, I love my sister, I love my brother, there are many ways by which I can express that love, right? When you're talking about loving an individual. I'm sorry, but when you say that you're loving God, I think that feeling becomes very, very abstract. And there are not many ways by which you can directly express that feeling. So you come up with many forms of expressing that feeling. When you say that I would like to offer my thoughts, words and deeds to God, how do you do that? So probably they would have come up with this idea that I take one flower and I say, I offer my thoughts to you. I take another flower, put it at the picture and say, I offer my words to you. So this becomes a ritual, but it is a physical expression of a feeling that otherwise cannot be expressed. For instance, we have this way of doing namaskar where you fall flat on your, on your body, which you call Sashtang Namaskar, which is also called Danvat Pranam in Sanskrit. Actually, that form of doing namaskar is a means of saying that I surrender to you. That's what they say, that if you take a stick and if you drop it, how it drops flat. So the person who says that I surrender to you, O Master, falls flat on the ground, right? So that is again, a surrender is a concept which is so very abstract. So how do you express that concept? So they find this way of having this, you know, a Sashtang Pranam, and we've heard many of these experiences where people would come and challenge Swami, and Swami would impress them with probably a beautiful miracle or revealing his omniscience. And the person is so thrilled that he falls flat at Swami's feet, which means that I surrender to you. I mean, I've been blown over by what you have told me or what you've done, so I surrender to you. So many times, many of these things that we do are an expression of a very subtle or a very abstract feeling. For instance, the other day I was listening to an interview of this very famous music director, A.R. Rahman, right? And he was being interviewed, and the interviewer asked him that, would you like to sing this particular qawwali, which is very, very popular. And A.R. Rahman, he said that, I would love to sing this qawwali, but if I have to sing this qawwali, I'll have to remove my footwear and sing. He said, because this is in praise of the Almighty Allah, and there are some words which are very, very beautiful and very, very sacred. So if I have to sing this qawwali, I'll have to remove my footwear and sing. And that's exactly what he did. So the idea is, you know, these are words that represent God. I am taking God's name, so I don't want to sing at least this particular song wearing my footwear. It is a form by which I express my, respect. So that is a tradition. But if you probably go to the West, you have Westerners going to a church wearing their slippers, right? I mean, you cannot say that that is completely wrong. And that's a different tradition. They might have a different way of showing their respect to God. So in our tradition, the way we show respect to God is by taking off our slippers. Right? So similarly, there are many, many such practices. If you look at it, there is this practice when you do Sandhya Vandanam. I might be wrong, but this is how I perceive it, that they take these 3-4 spoons of water and they drink it. So the idea is, I'm purifying, I'm taking this Ganga Jal and I'm purifying my body, I'm purifying my thoughts, I'm purifying my words. So how do you actually express that prayer that you're making mentally or verbally? So you attach a physical action to that, which becomes a ritual, which becomes like a custom. But the idea is, you're reminding yourself of this particular thought that you are expressing as a prayer, right? So this is the third category for which we, under which all our customs and rituals can come into. When we pray, why is this doubt coming at all, that when I'm taking the Lord's name, can I wear my footwear or not? Because in your heart there is this feeling that I need to respect this name, because this is God's name, this is Swami's name, I'm chanting this name, is it okay for me to wear my footwear? So that idea of this respect, how am I expressing? Or am I expressing disrespect without my knowledge? So many of the customs that we perform are either for this third category, where we want to express physically something which cannot be expressed because the feeling of the thought is very abstract or inexpressible. And the final thing which I would like to talk about is something which I've mentioned many times earlier. It's an attempt to create an ambience by which, you know, when we start doing, say, 3 or 4 of these steps, I take a bath, then I light an agarbatti, or I get flowers from the garden, you know, in the past. These would be the sequence of events before a person goes into the temple, to goes into his altar or puja room before he starts his puja. So these are different steps that he does. Why do we do these things? We might be creating an ambience by which every time we go into such an ambience, we more readily start thinking about God, right? I often make a reference to this scientific experiment by a scientist by name Pavlov. And Pavlov and the dog, it's a very famous experiment where, you know, he takes his dog, and every day when he brings food and puts it in front of the dog starts salivating, right? That's a natural process for the dog. So what he does is, every time he places food in front of the dog, he also rings a bell, right? And he does this over, several weeks. So this dog's mind makes this association with the bell ringing and the food which is placed in front of it. So after many weeks, what he does, he stops putting the food in front of the dog, but he only rings the bell. But the moment he rings the bell, the dog starts salivating, even though the food is not in front of it, right? Because the mind has made the subtle connection between that sound and preparation to eat. Many times, the rituals and customs that we follow is so that we can prepare our mind in this subtle manner. Some of the smells that are associated with the temple, some of the sights that are associated with the temple, the ambience around the temple, it is an attempt is made to keep it uniform, right, within the tradition or within a religion, so that the moment you go into that space, that sanctum, you automatically, your mind realizes that, you know, this is a place for which these are the kind of thoughts that have to be entertained in the mind. And without your knowledge, you know, some of us might call it vibrations. You know, I feel the very nice vibrations in this place. For me, I mean, much of it might actually be the ambience which is created around. And for that matter, there are many things that we even follow in the ashram, right? The kind of dressing that we want, the segregation of gender in sitting in mandir and in the canteens. Because the ashram has a certain disciplines, so that when you come and stay here for 3 days, 4 days, a week or a month, you know that, I mean, an ambience is created around so that your mind automatically realizes that these are the kind of thoughts that has to be entertained when I'm in this place. And this happens in a very, very subconscious level. So many times the traditional practices that we have, the different steps that we follow in a puja, you know, when we say that I go to a temple, I remove my slippers, or when I go to my puja room for my puja, I have a bath and go. I mean, all of these acts, as I said, I spoke about 4 categories, right? So sometimes many of the acts that we perform might fall in all of these 4 categories, right? But more importantly, what is the thing that you are thinking about, right? If I am taking off my slippers when I am thinking of Swami's name, or if I'm chanting Swami's name and I take off my slippers, and if I'm thinking that this is how I want to express my respect to Swami, I think that act automatically becomes an expression of this devotion, right? It's not a custom which is scientific, which is helpful for me, for my health or whatever it is. So for me, that act of performing, removing my slippers or having my bath and going, is my thought that when I go in front of Swami, I want to be respectful. Or for that matter, when we have a bath, when we wash our face, and we used to do that, you know, when towards the later years of 2008, 2009, when Swami started coming only in the evenings, you know, all our schedules shifted to the afternoon, in the sense that, you know, when we are wearing our best whites, we would always have this. We have a little pale whites and the best whites. The best whites was for when we were in front of Swami, right? So we would wear a pair of whites when we go for college, and then we wear a pair of clothes when we come for darshan. So the moment we start coming only for evening darshan, so all our schedule will shift accordingly. You know, we will all start shaving in the afternoon because that's when we're going to Swami. We will all start brushing our teeth again in the afternoon because in the afternoon we're going for Swami's darshan. So that is an idea that when I go in front of God, I need to be pure. And when I say I need to be pure and clean, it is actually in the mental level, but an expression of that feeling that when I go in front of Swami, I have to be pure, I express it even physically. Even physically, I wear fresh clothes, I have a bath, and I go fresh in front of Swami, right? So what we do need not necessarily be the same, it need not apply the same thing for another person, but it all comes down to how I would like to present myself in front of Swami, and how I would like to worship Swami, right? So whatever is being passed on in a traditional sense, if someone comes and tells you, no, this is how it has to be done, this is how a puja has to be done, this is how Sandhya Vandanam has to be done, this is how namaz has to be done, that is because of these three or four categories that I spoke about. For these various reasons, these traditions are passed down to us. But as I said in the very beginning, Swami has nothing to do with any of these things. It benefits us. Any form of discipline helps us control our mind, control our body. So any of these disciplines that we follow is good for us. It helps us focus better on Swami. It helps us probably maintain our hygiene and health. Probably it helps us think more clearly, make better decisions, be in calmness and peace, which all of us need so much. But does Swami say that only if you do all of these things, I'm going to accept your prayer? Well, it's not the case at all. Because all of these traditions and forms and practices that we speak about, they are all bahya, or external, or superficial. And Swami would often say, God is not bahya priya, but he is bhava priya. Which means God is not interested in the packaging in which your offering comes, but he is interested in the offering itself, which is supposed to be your love, which is supposed to be our devotion. So Swami is only interested in the bhavam. So you could be scrupulous in all of these things that has been passed down to you as tradition, but at the end of the day, if we are not able to offer that purity and love to Swami, then Swami would see it like an empty box being given to him on his birthday, right? But if none of this is there, but purely out of love, if you make an offering, I think that will be as acceptable to Swami. So that is what we see in these many stories of the Puranas, where, you know, even the story of somebody like Kannappa, who has this most unorthodox way of performing puja to Lord Shiva, but Lord Shiva accepts it. But even as I'm saying this, a small caveat, especially to the youngsters, this doesn't mean that all traditions and all these things need not be followed, because all of these also have a benefit, right? And that's what actually brings me to the second part of the answer, which is actually the answer for the question which was asked, which was about Namasmarana. So when we talk about Namasmarana as a spiritual practice, I think that's a completely different topic altogether. What we spoke about is the traditional form of worship, but what we're talking about Namasmarana is actually a little different. But even before I come to that Namasmarana, what is the point in all of these traditional forms of worship, and why as youngsters or as the new generation, we should not look at these practices and say that, oh, I don't believe in all this, I love Swami and that is more than enough, and, you know, I can even go to a late night party, but I'm still thinking about Swami and that is good enough. You know, many people get into all of these things. Why are these traditional forms of worship good? There is one thing which is there in this traditional form of worship, which is actually not always applicable to when we do Namasmarana, and that is, all of these are means by which you dedicate some time to the worship of Lord, right? Suppose I'm working here in the ashram, I'm working here at Radio Sai. If I take out some time and go and spend some time in the mandir for bhajans, I know that when I'm going for bhajans, I'll have to leave my slipper outside, I have to switch off my mobile, I can't keep checking my messages, I can't make points for my my programs. I'll have to sit there and I have to dedicate that half an hour, 45 minutes or 1 hour, whatever it is, for that worship. And that is what makes all of these traditional forms of worship, where we do certain things, we set aside time, we stop doing things which we would do in the rest of the day, and we do certain things only for this purpose of worship or puja. That is very important. Namasmarana is a different category of spiritual practice, but this one is a different sphere altogether, where you take out time from your busy schedule and say that this time I exclusively give it only for this purpose. And that has a lot of value, right? Apart from the four categories which I spoke, the different kinds of ways by which we get value out of these traditional forms of worship. Apart from that, this idea that I'm taking out time from my busy schedule and saying that this half an hour, this 45 minutes is dedicated to Swami, is dedicated for this puja, is dedicated for this archana or this japam or whatever it is. And when we do it like that, it is always good to follow all of these things. That sit straight, you know, don't lie down and do japam, or, you know, you sit in the puja room and do, you have a bath and go and do that. It is good to, some form of this traditional form of worship is always good for all of us. So youngsters who feel that these are all old traditional forms, Swami sees only love. Of course Swami sees only love, and that love can also be expressed in this form of a traditional worship. So never overlook this. You know, you or I may not have the interest and inclination to do a lot of this form of worship, but that's fine. If we don't relate to this form of worship and we want to find another form of worship, it's completely fine. But I think, let us not say that this is not valid at all or this is not necessary at all. Well, that is about all of these traditional forms of worship. But what is it about Namasmarana? As I said, you know, there are many purposes for the traditional style that we follow. And for that purpose, these traditional styles of worship is valid. So in that case, what is the purpose of Namasmarana? So when we are doing Namasmarana, we should ensure that whatever we do satisfies the purpose for which this act of Namasmarana as a spiritual discipline has been given to us by Swami. And Swami has spoken of Namasmarana as a much, much higher form of worship than any of these traditional forms. Swami does not say that don't do all of these, because Swami also speaks about bhajan. Swami has also taught us to chant Vedam. Swami has also performed so many of these yajnas and, you know, traditional Sita Kalyanams and Parvati Kalyanams and all of that, and we have witnessed all of that in Swami's presence. But Swami has spoken extensively about this virtue of Namasmarana, and Swami has also said that for the Kali Yuga, this is supposed to be the Dhanyopayam, which means that this is the one tool which is good enough to take you across your ocean of samsara. So Namasmarana is a different category of spiritual exercise. And what is the purpose of Namasmarana? That can be learned from this very, very beautiful Chinna Katha which Swami would often say. And I'm sure Mr. Narayanan, you will be aware of this, and most of your listeners also will know this, about this man who goes to a sage and tells him that, you know, I have a land, I need to do so much work, I don't have anybody to help me, I'm a lone man, and, you know, I have to take care of my family. I don't seem to be having enough time to do all of this. And so the sage says, okay, if that is the case, I can bless you with a genie, and this genie will do all the work that you want. And he's very good, very efficient, and he's very fast at whatever he does. So this man is very delighted, and he says, oh, Maharaj, that will be very, very good for me. I'll be very happy to receive that blessing from you, that grace from you. And then the sage gives him a condition. He says that, see, this genie is very, very effective and efficient and all of that, but it can never be idle. If you don't give it any work, and then it'll start chasing you and it'll try to eat you up. So unless you give it some work and if you keep it busy, then, you know, it'll take care of itself and it'll do all the work, but never let it be idle. So this man says, oh, that can never happen because I have so much work for it and I'm sure it's going to take a long time for it to finish whatever I wanted to do. So he goes back and then he tells this genie, you plow my field and then you sow the seeds. But this genie is like 10 or 15 times faster than any man can ever be, and he seems to be finishing up every work which is given to him in super fast time and comes back to the master and says, Master, the work is done, what next? So finally all the farming work is done and this man doesn't know what to do. So he tells the genie, okay, you build a house for me. And so this genie is in a flash at it, and after some time it's back and he says, the house is done. So this man, you know, I spoke about imaginative and creative thinking. He thinks up all the different kinds of works that he can probably offer this genie, but this genie seems to be much more efficient than he ever thought. So finally, when he runs out of any tasks and errands to give this genie, it starts chasing him. So this man comes running to the sage and he says, oh master, please save me, this genie is after me. So then the master says that, all right, you know, there is a way out for this. You ask the genie to erect a pole, get a huge pole from somewhere, erect it on the ground. And whenever you don't have any work for the genie, you ask it to climb up and climb down that pole. So, and that's how this problem is solved. So this man is happy with the genie and he has found a new way by which it can be kept occupied and it is never idle to trouble him. And Swami would give this Chinnakatha and say that, what is that genie that each one of you have? And that is the mind. Swami would say, this mind is so very efficient and it can accomplish a plethora of things. It can be so useful to you. But the problem is, whenever this mind is idle, it starts actually eating you. It starts harming you. So Swami says, so what is the thing that you have to do? You have to erect this pole and ask this genie to go up and down. And there are two things which Swami says. One is, Swami says, it is the soham meditation. The up and down climbing of the genie is, Swami says, equivalent to you concentrating on your breath, your inhalation and your exhalation, and you saying soham. Or the other form which Swami says is, it's about namasmarana. You, whenever you're free, you occupy your mind by doing namasmarana. So the idea of namasmarana itself is that you use it as a tool whenever your mind is not occupied with any other important task. So if you're asking, can I do namasmarana while I'm going on a walk? Can I do namasmarana on my commute? Can I do namasmarana when I'm lying on my bed and waiting to fall asleep? Can I do namasmarana? For instance, in India, you have long queues for everything. But can I do namasmarana when I'm waiting in a queue? Well, the answer is, of course, you can do. And in fact, we all must do. Every time when our mind is not occupied with anything which is useful, let me add that too, because now we have n number of ways by which we can keep our mind occupied. But if the mind is not being utilized in something which is a useful task, if the mind is free, Swami says, like that genie being asked to go up and down the pole, you give this task of thinking of the Lord's name constantly for the mind. Right? That is the task which has to be given to the mind. That is the role of namasmarana. Namasmarana is supposed to start, we are supposed to start by filling all the awakened times that we have with which we use our mind with this task of thinking of the Lord's name. So there is absolutely nothing wrong in chanting Swami's name, in chanting Sai Gayatri or whatever name that you want in the daily course of action when you're going for a walk, or when you're, as I said, waiting in a queue, waiting to buy a milk, or waiting in a queue to buy a theater ticket. Why not? At every time an opportunity is got, we have to think of the Lord's name. So in that sense, when we do namasmarana as a spiritual exercise, I think none of these conditions that we should not be wearing slippers, we should not be, doing this. There are a lot of people who, Swami would say this, I've heard Swami saying that when you have bath, you're supposed to do namasmarana. And when you do namasmarana, when you have bath, Swami said, it becomes like abhishekam. Because this body is like an idol, as good as an idol or a lingam or whatever it is, because it contains divinity inside. So when you're having bath, if you do Sai Gayatri, it is like doing abhishekam to Swami himself. So definitely Namasmarana can be done during all of these times. So that is the purpose. But that also is actually not the real purpose. That's only a means that we try to fill all the gaps in our time with Namasmarana. But what is the ultimate goal? What is that we are trying to reach? And that is what Swami explains. Many times you've heard this from Swami, and you know, Lord Krishna tells this in the Bhagavad Gita too, that whatever thought we have at the last moments of our life, the last concluding thoughts in our mind, if they are about God, if we are thinking about Swami at that time, Krishna says that they will attain me, right? If you're thinking of me in the last moments of your life, you will attain me. That is the promise which Krishna has given. That is the promise which Swami has given. But Krishna adds that it does not happen just like that. And we've heard a lot of Chinnakathas from Swami also, that, you know, you cannot, there is this businessman who names his four sons Rama, Krishna, Govinda, Gopala, and thinks that, you know, in the last minute when I'm dying, I'll anyway be calling out these fellows only and I'll be taking the Lord's name. And Swami says that it doesn't work that way, because this man at the last minute, he's thinking of his shop, because, you know, he calls these four children, they all come to his bedside and he says, all four of you are here, who's taking care of my shop? And he dies thinking of his shop, because that's what he has done all his life. He's been thinking of his shop and his business all the while. So Krishna says that if you have to die with thoughts of me in the last moments of your long, long life, then you should have lived your life thinking about me. And that's why Krishna says in the 8th chapter, Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu mam anusmara yudhyacha mai arpita mano buddhir mam evaisyasya asamshaya. Sorry, really bad at quoting Sanskrit verses. But that's the beautiful verse which Krishna says. The meaning of that is, therefore, Arjuna, you should always think of me in the form of Krishna, and at the same time, carry out your prescribed duty of fighting with your activities dedicated to me and your mind and intelligence fixed on me. And if you do this, you will attain me without doubt. Asamshayaha, the word which I was struggling to pronounce, right? So what Krishna says is, if you think of me all the time during your life, and the beautiful word, the beautiful phrase in that shloka which I read out is, mam anusmara yudhyacha. He says, mam anusmara. Smaranam means is to think of the Lord, right? Namasmarana is to think of the Lord's name, keep repeating it in our mind. But he is saying, mam anusmara. He says, every moment you should think of me. And Swami would often say this, anusmarana, your namasmarana should eventually lead you to anusmarana, which means that every moment you are constantly thinking about the Lord's name, you're constantly chanting the Lord's name. If you reach that state in the last moments, whatever be the cause for your death, whatever be the reason why you are at the jaws of death, it could be ill health, it could be pain, it could be an accident, or it could be just old age, whatever it is, in the last moments, you will think of me, right? And what a beautiful combination of two things. He says, mam anusmara yudhyacha. Krishna is telling Arjuna that you constantly think of me and you go and fight. Well, there in Arjuna's context, to fight in the battle versus dharma, but if we were to interpret this for ourselves, constantly do whatever is your righteous duty. That duty which is prescribed for each one of us has to be done. The mind has to be completely used for that, with full involvement, with full focus in whatever we are supposed to do. And the starting point is, every other time when the mind is not fully involved in our dharma, in our dharmic activities, the mind has to dwell on the Lord's name. And when that happens, after a period of time, Swami says, it will become anusmarana. It's literally like how we don't have to be conscious about our breathing. The breathing constantly happens. You know, whatever we are doing, it doesn't stop us from breathing. It constantly happens in the background. Swami says, similarly, you will reach a state where you are constantly repeating the name, whatever you're doing, whether your mind is occupied or it is idle, you will constantly be chanting my name. So the whole idea of Namasmarana as an exercise is to reach the stage of Anusmarana, where whatever I am doing, whatever activity in the day I am doing, a pleasant activity, unpleasant activity, a a very clean and noble activity, a very dirty activity according to us, whatever it is, you're constantly thinking about Swami, you're constantly chanting His name. That is the state we have to reach. So when we're talking about Namasmarana as a spiritual practice, this is the goal. So when this is the goal, when this is the purpose, it doesn't matter whether we are wearing slippers, whether we're doing it lying down, whether we're doing it sitting up. In fact, you know, that is the beauty of Namasmarana. Because many times when I wonder, you know, what is that one activity which will ensure that a person will reach God, right? Is there any one activity? Is there any one spiritual practice which we can give to somebody and say that this will definitely guarantee take you to your goal? If you talk of something like bhajans, the question is, what if that person is, you know, he's not a good singer or he does not have interest in music, let's say. Then probably, you know, he's not going to relish the idea of singing bhajans, and that bhajans is not going to give him that fulfillment. Or what about something like seva? If you tell that seva is the ultimate means to your goal, what about those people who are probably physically challenged, who have a disability of a kind because of which they have to be recipients of other seva and they are not able to do seva themselves? Then how can something be the ultimate means of reaching the goal if it is excluding certain people out of it? The only tool which can be applicable to everybody, be it a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old, an 80-year-old, be it a person who is on his deathbed, be it a person who is in the prime of his youth, if there is one activity which is applicable to everybody, Swami says that is only Namasmarana. So that Namasmarana does not have any conditions. You have to wear these things, you have to do these things, you have to, you know, prepare yourself by doing these things. Yes, all of them will have their benefits, just like how I explained. If doing Namasmarana, if you go to your puja room, if you sit there and if you close your eyes and you shut yourself from all your gadgets, and if you do, it has its own benefits, but none of it is a precondition. But eventually, even Namasmarana, what does Swami accept from it? What Swami accepts is only that bhavam, is only that feeling. And there is this beautiful Chinnakatha which I've not heard it from Swami, but I've read it somewhere, where, you know, Hanuman is going around the world. Hanuman is supposed to be a Chiranjivi, and wherever he hears Lord Rama's name being taken with much devotion, he gets drawn to that place. So when he's going around the world, at one particular place, somebody is singing a beautiful Rama bhajan, and he's chanting Rama's name, and the love with which this person was taking Rama's name literally pulls Hanuman there. And, you know, he's drawn to that place, he goes there, and when he goes there, to his utter shock, he sees that this man who is sitting and answering nature's call is actually chanting Ramanam. And he is furious. He said, you know, how sacred is Ramanam? It's the most glorious of all names. And how dare you take Rama's name and contemplate Rama when you're answering nature's call, which is supposed to be the dirtiest activity which we do in the day, right? So he gets so wild with him and gives him a tight slap and threatens him. He says, never do this again. So the story goes that when he goes to Lord Rama, or he has a dream in which Lord Rama comes with, you know, a swollen cheek, where Rama says that you slapped me. And Rama tells him that, you know, what matters to me is that a devotee should take my name with love. That's all which matters to me. And whatever be the condition he is in, if he does this, it reaches me. I don't care what he is doing at that time, in which place he is, whether he is in a temple, if whether he is in Mount Kailash, or whether he is in his own toilet. It doesn't matter to me, right? So definitely for Namasmarana, none of these conditions are there. The only thing that we need to ensure, whether we are doing puja of the traditional kind or Namasmarana, which we do all the time, we should pray that, you know, in some form, this love becomes pure enough, worthy of being accepted by Swami. That's all we need to do. That pretty much answers the question, or rather, the question was answered in the very first sentence. As I said, I just thought we'll take this opportunity to speak about this a little more. We still have time, so I thought probably I'll share a beautiful story. It's very interesting. It was narrated by one of our guests when the Telugu team interviewed a person, and this person came to Swami in the 1950s. And this person still lives in the ashram, by the way. And he was narrating how his interaction with Swami and how his journey with Swami began, and it began in a very, very sweet and beautiful way. And I think it's perfectly in context, especially in the context of this question. So I thought I'll share it with all of you. So here was this boy who came to Swami. He came to Swami as a very young boy at the age of 10, right? So he comes to Swami probably in 1953 or 55. Comes from a very ordinary family, close to somewhere in Nellore. And he says that, you know, he comes from a very big family. They had lands, and most of them in their family were educated up to 4th or 5th standard. But after that, they would tend to cattle, or they would take care of their lands, help their father in the land, or, you know, tend to cattle. So his role in the family was tending to cattle. So they had about 10 buffaloes, which he would take in the morning, and, you know, till sometime late in the afternoon, he would take these cattle around, and he would come back. And as we all know, that there are rules that your cattle cannot go into somebody else's land. It'll have to either be in your own land or in the common pastures. So that's why that was this boy's task, right? So eventually he comes to know about Swami. That's a long story. Probably I'll narrate that some other time. But a beautiful sequence of events brings him to Swami. He comes and sees Swami for the first time. And imagine, we interviewed this person a couple of years back when he was, I think he's almost 70 something now, understandably. But he was saying that when he went to Swami as a 10-year-old boy in 1950, Swami came in the balcony and Swami looked at him and Swami blessed him with his hands. And he said that even now, if he closes his eyes, that is the image which comes in front of his eyes, because that first moment when he saw Swami, 1950s, you can imagine how beautiful Swami would have been, you know, how tender and how loving. Swami is always like that. But you will agree with me that the 50s, 60s, there was a different charm altogether. So this boy was so taken in by that beautiful form of Swami, and he says that he comes back, that one sight of Swami coming and blessing him from the balcony literally got imprinted in his mind, and he was so very happy for that moment. So this boy, you know, makes this trip with his aunt to Parthi for the first time. So he goes back home, and, you know, he starts describing Swami to his mother. He says, "Oh, my, you know, mother, I saw Swami. There is absolutely no doubt he is God, because he is so beautiful. You know, his smile is so charming. He's wearing such a beautiful pitambaram. And, you know, the charm on his face, how do I explain it? You know, he must be God because he's so beautiful." And, you know, this is the beauty of motherhood. The mother is so happy for the boy. But the mother tells him, you know, that is not enough. Just seeing Swami, even knowing that this is Swami, is not enough. If you feel that he is God, then you have to chant his name. If you don't do Namasmarana, that blessing that you've got will wither away, will go waste. So this boy says, definitely, mother, I will do. So the mother instructs him that you should chant Swami's name at least 3,000 times a day. So this boy says that, okay, when I take the cattle out for grazing, I will sit under a tree and I will chant. So the mother gives him a japamala made of rudraksham, and this boy sits under the tree from that day on. And he says that it was actually a garland of 100 beads. So he would do 30 cycles of that japamala, and he would take a palm leaf and he would draw 30 lines. He would do 3,000 times he had to do, right? So 30 lines he would draw on that palm leaf as a count of finishing that japamala 30 times. So at the end of the day, he had to go and show his mother that I did this japam, and the mother would be very happy. So one day, this boy comes back and he shares with his mother an observation that he's had in the past few months. He does this for about 6 or 7 months, by the way. So he comes and tells his mother, you know, mother, there's a very strange thing that's happening ever since I started doing Swami's, started chanting Swami's name. That earlier when I used to take the cattle, I had to be very, very conscious of where the cattle is going, because if you leave them alone for a few minutes, they would stray into somebody else's field. But I realized that when I'm sitting under this tree and chanting Swami's name, the cattle don't seem to go astray at all. They're all where they are, and I don't even have to get up and go and tend to them. They behave so in such a disciplined manner. And the mother tells him, you know, it's very obvious, because when you chant Swami's name, when you take Swami's name, Swami will come and do your work. Swami will come and do whatever work you are supposed to do. And so this boy is very thrilled. The next day, he again takes the cattle for grazing. He sits under the tree and takes out his japamala. And this boy, probably 10-year-old, you know, in all his sweet innocence, he starts wondering, you know, my mother told me this, that when you chant Swami's name, Swami comes and does your work. And he recollects the form of Swami that he saw. He said Swami was so tender, Swami was looking so sweet. That robe which Swami was wearing was so clean and beautiful and so pure. How bad it would be if Swami has to come and tend to my cattle, to these 10 buffaloes. So he said, you know, I am chanting Swami's name and I am enjoying it, but I am making Swami come and do my work. And he said, this is not right. So I will not chant Swami's name sitting here and henceforth. So he goes back home that evening. His mother asks him, you know, have you done, where's your, palm leaf? Where is the japam that you've done today? So then this boy says, no, today I didn't do. So then the mother asks him, he explains that this is the reason. So then he gives a word to his mother, that, mother, but don't worry, I will finish all my work. I'll come back in the evening. I'll help you in the kitchen. I'll take care of whatever I need to do, whatever is my duty. And after that, at around 8 o'clock, I will sit and do my japam. Right? At that time, I would have finished all my work. So Swami will not have to come and do my work. So I will sit and do this japam. So the mother says, all right. So then this boy starts this practice. From 8 to about 10, 10:30 in the night, he would sit and do this japam of 3,000 times Swami's name. A couple of months pass and another aunt who visits Puttaparthi comes home. So this boy runs to this aunt and asks her, you know, how is Swami? Did you have Swami's darshan? Did Swami speak to you? So then this boy asks this aunt, what is the schedule that Swami follows? What time does he wake up? What time does he come for darshan and all that? Because the first time when he goes for Swami's darshan, he stays there only for 2 or 3 days and he does not have the chance to observe Swami so well. So then this aunt of his tells him about Swami's schedule and she says that it looks like Swami retires pretty early. The lights in his room are switched off by 7 o'clock, so maybe Swami sleeps up by 7, 7:30. And when this boy hears that, he starts wondering. He says, oh my God. And then he asks his aunt that when we do Namasmarana, when we chant Swami's name, when we take Swami's name, does it reach him? Does he listen to that? So the aunt says, of course, if you call God's name, God always listens. So then this boy starts thinking, 7 o'clock Swami sleeps. 8 o'clock I wake him up again by doing Namasmarana. So Swami has to again get up and listen to my Namasmarana till 10:30 and then only he can go back to sleep. How bad it is of me to disturb Swami's sleep like this. And he thinks this way and he stops doing Namasmarana even in the evening. And the mother observes this for a couple of days and calls this boy and says, hey, you said you will do it in the evening and now you've stopped doing that also. Then the boy explains this logic, this innocent, sweet logic of his. And then the mother and the aunt and all explain to him that, no, it's not like that. See, Swami is omnipresent. When we say that Swami does our work, it does not mean that Swami comes physically and does our work. And when we say that Swami listens, it does not mean that Swami is awake or asleep. He is God, he is always awake, he doesn't sleep at all. And they give him all the philosophical explanations. And finally, the boy is satisfied and he says, all right, I'll chant Swami's name. So in the midst of all these dilemmas and confusions of when to chant Swami's name, how to chant Swami's name, is he disturbing Swami, is it all right? Finally, they make a trip to Puttaparthi. His second trip to Parthi, and this time his mother also comes, and he goes there, and Swami calls him for an interview on one particular day. And he said that he used to participate in the morning Suprabhatam every day. He goes for Suprabhatam for 3 days, but after that he starts getting cough and cold, so he's not able to go in the morning. So he skips about 2 or 3 days. So after the 2 or 3 days, Swami calls him for an interview, and Swami asks him, hey, first 3 days you came for Suprabhatam, and after that you don't seem to be coming. So then this boy says, no, Swami, I had cough. And then very innocently he takes courage and asks Swami, but Swami, how do you know? Because in the mornings, the lights are off in the mandir, and I don't see Swami also coming out. Then even if you come out, when it's all dark, how can you make out that I have not come? So Swami laughs at his innocence and Swami says, you know, not only in this mandir, Bangaru, I can see what happens in every corner of this universe and I'm aware all the time. So as I said, you know, when you hear a statement like this from Swami, what do you do? This boy falls flat and does a sashtang to Swami and, you know, for the revelation which Swami made. So Swami lifts him up and Swami materializes some vibhuti and puts it into his mouth and Swami says, don't worry, your cough will subside. And then Swami lifts this boy's shirt and that banyan which he was wearing, a typical village boy, right? And Swami smears the remaining vibhuti on his chest. And Swami says, don't worry, even the congestion will go. So this boy comes back and tells his mother that what all happened and they're very happy. But he observes something from that very moment he steps out of the interview room, that he realizes that when Swami applied that vibhuti on his chest, from that moment, the Namasmarana which he was doing starts becoming so spontaneous and automatic. Literally, he says, it is like a tape recorder which is going on in the background, that Anusmarana that we spoke about. Because here was the little boy who had all these confusions in his mind, and it was all out of his pure devotion, right? It was not out of logic. It was not out of a scientific understanding or anything. Pure love and devotion for Swami. Am I disturbing Swami? Am I making Swami do my work? And all this confusion, which is the right time to fit in that Namasmarana so that I don't trouble Swami. As a blessing for that, what does Swami do? In that one act of applying vibhuti on his chest, Swami makes this Namasmarana constant in his mind. So much so that from that moment he says, I'm 70 years old now, but even now that tape recorder is running in the background. That Namasmarana which you're struggling to do is happening constantly. I think that is the blessing which Swami gives for pure love. But just to complete the story, he goes back and, you know, this Namasmarana is going on. He's very, very happy. And he goes back to his normal life. He's tending cattle and, you know, he's doing whatever he's doing. So one day when he is going with his father from his, towards his fields from home, there is a Mahalakshmi temple in that village. So he sees that people who go near that temple, when they want to offer pranams to the goddess, they remove their slippers, they pray to the goddess, and then they wear the slippers and go. So this little boy asks his father, you know, why do they do this? When they pray to God alone, they remove their slippers, they pray, and then they wear it back. So then the father says, yeah, when you're taking God's name, you should not wear slippers. It's very disrespectful. And the father tells that and they start going. But this boy now starts thinking. He says, all the time Swami's name is running in my mind. I'm chanting Swami's name 24/7. Then how can I wear slippers? Imagine the innocence of that 10-year-old, 11-year-old boy. And this thought now starts troubling him. So one day what he does, he takes his slippers and throws it away. And his father asks him, what's wrong with you? Why are you doing this? Because, you know, it's the villages of the 1950s. There is no proper road. You have to walk into the jungle. You have to walk into the fields. And this boy says, no, I'm not going to wear slippers anymore because I am chanting Swami's name all the time. And it is disrespectful to wear slippers when you take Swami's name. And that was the last time this boy wore footwear. Even till today, I told you, he works in the ashram, he stays in the ashram, he does not wear his footwear at all. And it is not about wearing footwear or not wearing footwear, it's not about what time of the day you'll do Namasmarana, but it is just that love, right? That feeling that, you know, I'm doing this for Swami, it should not trouble Swami, it should not disturb Swami. That feeling of selflessness, it is not about which way, if I do, I will get the maximum benefit out of this spiritual activity. It is, I am enjoying this, I love doing this, I love taking Swami's name, but hopefully I'm not troubling Swami. That innocence, that pure love of a little boy, see the way Swami responds to that, right? So I think that, I mean, few years back when I heard the story, I was so fascinated by this. And we hear Chinnakathas, we hear stories about Hanuman saying that he is constantly chanting Rama's name and all of that. It is possible even today. That blessing Swami can give you and me. But we just have to seek that. Is that what we want? And I mean, that is the beauty of living with Swami, that all of these stories which we have only read in books is actually happening to you and me, to the people around us. And with that, I conclude this answer. Thank you for this opportunity to share this story once again with all of you. I thank Mr. Narayanan for that question. It did appear simple, but it is a very, very important and very profound question. Thank you for that. And I hope I've answered at least partially the doubt which has been in your mind. I think it's time to wrap up, dear listeners. I've gone over my time already. If you have a question that troubles you on how to practice Swami's message in daily life, and if you'd like me to answer that question on the show, please feel free to write to me. You can write to me in my personal mail ID, that's prem@radiosai.org. PREM at radiosci.org. And if you could record the question in your own voice like Mr. Narayanan did today, it would be beautiful to have it in your own voice. It gives a beautiful break for all of us as you're listening to my boring voice for an entire hour. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. And I'm going to leave you with a very, very beautiful song on Namasmarana, sung by the Malladi brothers. I've sung this in Swami's presence many times. On the other side of the song, you'll be joined by Raghu with this next segment of Today's Thursday Live. But I'll be back around 12:30 for the next episode of Afternoon Satsang. But next week at 11 a.m., I'll join you for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇగ పరల నొసగు సాధనం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇగ పరల నొసగు సాధనం సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి పొందగలుగు జన్మ ఇదేనని చాడిన సాయి. సాయి నామస్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇక పరాల దొసగు సాధనం. సాయి నామస్మరణం సాయి రూప.